This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
This talk may be more particular and less theoretical than the other ones in theorizing in particular have been. And I've listened on the audio to a couple of them, parts of them. I've tried in this book, and so in the paper that draws from a few sections of the book, to work in to problems that have been and are being treated on a theoretical register, but to do so in a kind of an unstrenuous idiom and without sort of reflexive nomination of my academic interlocutors. And I'm not sure, finally, you know, whether that is my best strategy, but that's for I did try to put a little bit of a theoretical frame around this for this occasion, so see how that goes. Anyway, the book, as you've heard, is on prizes and awards in literature, the arts, the fields of entertainment. And this is a topic, everyone says this about their topic, it's true in my case, it's over-familiar and under-examined. I don't think there's any form of cultural capital so ubiquitous, so powerful, so widely talked about, and yet so little explored by scholars as the cultural prize. There's no book other than the one I'm working on. Prizes and awards fairly dominate the cultural landscape these days, literally tens of thousands of them. Vying for a notice, lists of them appearing in every resume, every promotional blurb, every feature story or obituary of practically anyone connected with the production of art. Indeed, the sense that the cultural universe is oversaturated with prizes, that there are more prizes than our collective cultural achievements can possibly justify, is the great and recurring theme of prize punditry. Gore Vidal says in the U.S. there are more literary prizes than there are writers. Peter Porter, the Australian poet, says there are so many prizes in his country that, quote, there's hardly any writer in Sydney who has not won one. A British novelist jokes about attending a great literary function in Bloomsbury, where he turned out to be, quote, one of only two fiction writers present never to have won a literary award, and where the other writer was remaining undetected by claiming to have won an award of his own invention, the Pemberton Frost Memorial Prize. Sounds plausible. So the author of this piece found himself in the perfect comic inversion of the normative prize scenario, the lone loser emerging from the congested field of winners. The whole literary awards scene, as numerous commentators have observed, has come to resemble the caucus race of Alice's Adventure in Wonderland, where you may remember that Dodo announces that everybody has won and all must have prizes. It's not just in literature that this the situation obtains. Woody Allen famously remarked that Hollywood's devotion to awards was so excessive they could give Hitler an award for greatest fascist dictator. And I've seen that joke circulating everywhere. Journalism, LA, architecture, all the fields where there are prizes, which is to say all the fields. The same complaint, mockingly or disdainfully put, appears across the entire cultural universe. So many awards, as a columnist reviewing the New Music Award shows put it, so little excellence. But this joke and the attitude it bespeaks of sneering indifference or disparagement toward the awards industry has kept us from making any rigorous inquiry into the cultural logic in which prizes today are so inextricably embedded. It is, in fact, a residual joke, out of step with the contemporary, pitched along lines which are essentially modern and which depend on a certain consensus, and you could say a certain faith, among the actual producers of art regarding the distinction, indeed the opposition, between legitimate forms of artistic recognition on the one hand and mere bourgeois credentials or consecrations on the other. Honor's dishonor, Flaubert famously said. But that resoundingly simple dictum no longer holds today in the way it did 100 or even 30 years ago, although, and this is just as important, it has not ceased to reverberate powerfully, even for us, who are presumed to know better, or to possess a crucial tactical utility within the sights of contemporary culture. The game called culture is played differently now than it used to be, with more diverse agents, institutional as well as individual agents, employing more complex and varied strategies. those of us who are interested in what Pierre Bourdieu has called the rules of art, we do well to put our habitual sneers aside and begin to inquire more systematically into the prize's functioning, both in the narrow sense, as a piece of objectified symbolic capital, sort of hard credential that is to cultural capital, what money is to economic capital. And in a broader sense, as an instrument of exchange and conversion with its own particular rules of operation, its own class of operatives or functionaries, its own historical trajectory across the fields of culture. Just what value do prizes carry in the postmodern economy of cultural prestige, and how do they retain this value in the face of their seemingly numerous and powerful detractors? Now, by invoking Bourdieu, employing from the outset Bourdieuian terminology, I mean to indicate a certain level of agreement with his reflexive sociology of art, and with the larger project he's called the general economy of practices. More agreement, certainly, than most American students of literary and cultural theory would be willing to accept. It's not my purpose here to account for the rejection of Bourdieu among American literary scholars, something that John Guillory tried to do in an article called Bourdieu's Refusal. Nor do I intend to defend Bourdieu from his critics, a task to which more thoroughgoing disciples than I, Louis Forcamp being probably the most important, are better suited. But while I believe with some of Bourdieu's critics that this economic model of cultural practice has failed to yield anything like a convincing theory of the subject, that he ultimately offers us a subject that's no better articulated along axes of race, sexuality, desire, than the economic man of neoclassical economics itself. I agree with critics on that, but this model remains, in my view, the most robust theoretical framework within which to explore the problem of cultural prestige. My aim, of course, is not simply to reproduce and elaborate, but substantially to revise the relational map of the cultural field that reflexive sociology now offers us. This map is comprised of what Bourdieu calls circuits of legitimation, systems of sponsorship, evaluation, and consecration, by means of which power euphemizes itself as merit, as intrinsic and proper rather than imposed and arbitrary, and thereby secures its symbolic efficacy. In modern times, and especially with the rise of modern educational institutions, these circuits have become ever longer and more complex, assuring some progress in symbolic efficacy to offset the erosion of tyrannical power and this direct, that would be generally hereditary transfer. But it is also this increasing dependency on increasingly remote and complex circulations of symbolic capital that has left the dominant groups susceptible to subversive misappropriations of that capital along the way. This is just paraphrasing Bourdieu, who's saying something that's not hasn't already been said by other people in other terminologies. This ambiguity or paradox of power, what Bourdieu calls the relationship of dependence in and through independence that binds cultural power to temporal power, has become especially vexed in recent decades as the economy of artistic capital, for all its increasing complexity, has undergone a curious sort of selective demystification, a partial shedding of euphemisms. There's been a shift in the illusio of cultural practice, in the very ways that one finds it possible to believe in art and to articulate that belief. And this has forced the agents of cultural production to become more self-conscious about their dependent independency and to develop new, more ambiguous strategies or styles of play. As a particularly vivid and problematic instrument of legitimation, the prize can help us to clarify this new situation of the cultural field, and so perhaps to identify more successfully than Bourdieu has done some forms of subversive misappropriation suited to the postmodern moment. And I'm going to use that term postmodern without apology and without scare quotes. So there. I was reading a book yesterday on the train, and every time postmodernism appeared in the introduction, there was this elaborate throat clearing and quotation marks and apologies and footnotes. And, oh, God, and it just stopped. So I'm not going to do it. It is evident. That concludes my theoretical preamble, such as it is. It's evident that for arts page editors, book reviewers, and other journalists of culture, including prominently academic journalists, a certain internalized prohibition has long obtained in regard to warmly appreciated or openly supported commentary on prizes and awards. The situation varies somewhat as we move along the art entertainment spectrum, but there's a general attitude of mocking condescension, which, particularly where prizes in the legitimate arts are concerned, is put to work in strategic accordance with the journalistic capacity for the production of scandal. Bourdieu has observed it. Scandal is the instrument par excellence of symbolic action, while Joan Shelley Rubin and Janice Bradley have shown how the 20th century's most effective instruments of cultural exchange, that is, those by means of which the fungibility or interconvertibility of cultural or cultural with non-cultural capitals has been facilitated and exploited, that these instruments have produced on the field where academia and journalism converge a series of scandals of the middle ground. Such scandals consist rhetorically of howls of outrage fastened onto any particular gap or embarrassment of the moment, but ultimately directed at the mediating institution as such, which is accused of furthering the encroachments of the marketplace or politics or of personal connections onto the artistic field, and hence of diluting what ought to be pure cultural capital with economic, political, or social capital. There's little need to document this line of commentary with regard to cultural prizes, since it is familiar to us all. I believe, in fact, that though its specific forms and ideological functions have changed, such commentary is as old as prizes themselves, as old at any rate as the classical drama prizes of the 5th century BC, and that scandal, or at least the threat and promise of scandal, is in fact constitutive of prizes as we know them. What I want to discuss today is the postmodern form of this constitutive threat, the gradual shift of prize commentary in recent years onto a register of mock scandal, whereby the prize can continue to occupy discursively the place of the illegitimate, the embarrassing, the scandalously middling institution of culture, a place with which no serious critic or artist wants to be too firmly associated, while securing, in fact, an even greater efficacy among not only the consumers of art, but the producers, the serious academic critics and artists themselves. In describing this change in commentary on prizes, I'll focus initially on Britain's Booker Prize for Fiction. It's no secret that the success of the Booker Prize, its seemingly magical power to attract the attention both of the broad book-reading public and of the most critically respected British novelists, is bound up with the annual flurry of scandal that attends it in the dailies and in the literary press. Founded in 1968 as the brainchild of Tom Ashlow, a rising young celebrity author, celebrity editor at Jonathan Cape, and under the sponsorship of Booker PLC, then a post-colonial agribusiness company seeking to diversify domestically and to improve its public profile, the prize was not, in fact, well-positioned to succeed. It lacked the important symbolic distinction of being the oldest book prize in Britain. Not only were there continuous prizes dating back half a century, the James K. Black and Hawthorne, but there were already other newcomers, such as the Guardian Fiction Prize, which had been founded in 65, and the Silver Pen Fiction Prize, which had been announced earlier in 1968. While the Booker's cash value of £5,000 was somewhat higher than others initially, this has not remained the case and was never a very significant differentiating mark. Maybe overstating it a little. It was something, but it wasn't decisive. Nor was the Booker on any account remarkable for its professed criteria or aims. It was a novel of the year prize on the Goncourt model, consciously on the Goncourt model, as were the others. Though the Booker organization would deny this today, the whole venture was very close to folding within just a couple of years of its launch. The private correspondence and minutes from committee meetings in 1970 and 1971 read like the black box transcript of a crashed plane. Publishers are threatening to stop nominating books. The people they invite to be judges are routinely refusing. They have to go to a second and then a third list to get sign up the judges. Nashler insists on acting like the chair of the management committee, which he's not. The actual chair, which is inappropriate for a number of reasons, mainly he's the publisher of some of the books that nominated. The actual chair resigns. The book trust was brought in to administer the prize, though they'd never administered the prize before. And the sponsor, though committed to an initial 7 years of funding, is already making sounds of an early exit. I got my hands on these documents, which are not supposed to be public. through a clerical error. And I'm not sure what to do with it. But here I can tell you, it's pretty ugly stuff. But what happened instead is that the Booker began in 1971 to deliver a series of annual scandals, the best known of which is that of John Berger in his rude acceptance speech of 1972, when Berger, who was then enjoying the celebrity of the BBC Ways of Seeing series, denounced the Booker Corporation as a colonialist enterprise built on the backs of black workers in plantation work in Guyana, and declared that half his prize money would be given to the London branch of the Black Panthers, which didn't exist anymore, but but it was the thought that counted. This incident alone gave an enormous boost to the Booker's public profile, but it had been prepared for by a forgotten scandal of the year before, another intemperate, but this time politically right-wing, outburst by another literary television personality, Malcolm Muggeridge, who was then referred to as St. Muggs. He was doing, in those years, a Sunday morning TV show called The Question Why. It was a Christian show. Muggeridge caused a scandal when he withdrew as the head of the judges in a huff, saying that all of the books were pornographic. And then the year after Berger's speech, there was another anti-Booker political speech by J.G. Farrell. So there were three in a row, and it's kind of snowballed. And by early 74, going back to the archive, the tone of frustration is entirely absent from the committee's minutes as they congratulate themselves on a very satisfactory result, and particularly on the fact that, quote, publicity for the prize has not gained its own value. Press coverage has risen to about 50 stories in 71 and 272, grows by half again, as many as 73. Publishers have stopped complaining about the entry fees, prestigious judges have become easy to find, and Booker PLC happily renewed its 7-year sponsorship in the fall of 74. Within two more years, the BBC had decided to televise the awards ceremony, a development which in turn led the organizing committee to revise its procedures along more Oscar-like lines, with the judge's decision withheld, kept under conditions of maximum security until it could be revealed to the assembled shortlisted authors who were assembled under conditions of maximum anxiety and, of course, close public scrutiny to endure the announcement. This celebrity sadism, as one famous writer called it, ensured that incidents of scandalous misbehavior, rush keep pounding his fists on the table, and so on, would be even more regular and could be even more eagerly anticipated. The journalists covering the Booker Prize could be sure of getting just the kind of cultural material they require. Just a decade after its near collapse, the Booker outstripped all other British literary prizes combined in terms of sheer volume of publicity, renown, and book sales that it could generate for its winner. Even to be shortlisted for the Booker was a distinction of greater value, symbolic as well as monetary, than any other prize could muster. To win it, as Thomas Keneally's editor said, Keneally received the 82 prize for Schindler's List, was like an avalanche hitting you all at once. While the reshaping during this period of the relationship between journalistic and cultural capital, celebrity and canonicity, was not a function of conscious agency, much less that of the Booker's organizers, those individuals, and specifically the prize's chief administrator, Martin Goff, were fully complicit in exploiting the association of the Booker with scandal, wagering that the prize stood to reap the greatest symbolic profit precisely from its status as a kind of cultural embarrassment. Goff could see that each new scandal provoked objection, not just to a particular jury. There's plenty of space in here. You need to see it. He could see that the scandals didn't just provoke a debate over a particular choice, for example, of the judges to award the prize to this or that author. It wasn't a matter of addressing only the single controversy, but always to use each controversy to rehearse the more fundamental dispute over the Booker Prize itself. In the Times, the Booker has been dismissed as, these are all quotes, rubbish, mere razzmatazz, a laughing stock, a an annual rusty nail hammered in the coffin of fiction. The Daily Telegraph has called it an embarrassment to the entire book trade. The Economist has pronounced it a sad and shoddy farce, adding that it's time for the backers to call it a day. Such wholesale denunciations, appearing in the most powerful journals, are clearly not an unhappy side effect of the promoter's publicity strategy, but a central aim. It is the charge of fundamental, irremediable illegitimacy that keeps the prize focus of attention, increasing its journalistic capital, and speeds its accumulation of symbolic capital for cultural prestige. Far from posing a threat to the prize's advocacy as an instrument of the cultural economy, scandal is its lifeblood. Far from constituting a critique, indignant commentary about the prize is an index of its normal and proper function. Until quite recently, though, there has not been much room in the game to acknowledge the simple fact of complicity or convergence of interests between the more or less lofty and disdainful cultural commentators and those who have a direct stake in promoting the prize and enlarging its cultural role. Instead, commentators tended, misleadingly if not disingenuously, to describe the relationship between the booker's increasingly privileged cultural position and its perceived scandalousness as a paradoxical one, the prize having miraculously succeeded in spite of all the outraged and scandalized book critics. The tendency of commentators automatically to describe the situation in this way as a strange deviation from the normal, proper, or expected course of things has depended on their misapprehension of the economy of cultural prestige and of their own place in the economy. Arts editors, book reviewers, and academics who write for the newspapers who do book chat on TV are by no means perfectly opposed to the sponsors and administrators of prizes, nor where the two sets of interests do diverge do the writers stand to gain by driving prizes off the cultural field altogether. Prizes are as useful to them as the sponsoring corporations and societies, of which in many cases they are members or proxies. That is the corporations and societies that sponsor the prizes. Apart from being a means of derivative consecration for journalist critics themselves, since members of this faction often receive the symbolically subsidiary but structurally primary honor of being asked to serve as nominators or judges. Prizes have traditionally been useful as well in providing occasions for journalist critics to rehearse in passionate tones the enlightenment pieties about pure art and authentic forms of greatness or genius, and thereby, however hypocritically, to align themselves with higher values or more symbolically potent forms of capital than those which dominate the scandalously impure prize economy, as well as the journalistic field itself. Such rehearsals, I should add, do nothing to discredit the cultural prize, and in fact serve as a crucial support for it, inasmuch as they help to keep aloft the collective belief or make-believe in artistic value as such, and the disinterested judgment of taste, the hierarchy of value or prestige that's not a homology of social hierarchy, is not a euphemized form of social violence. The prize depends on this collective belief, since its own currency, however tainted or debased, is understood to derive from this other and purer form, which stands in relation to the economy of cultural prestige, as gold did to the cash economy in the days of the gold standard, perfectly magical guarantor of an imperfectly magical system. In any event, the fiction that scandalized commentators stand outside of and in opposition to the culture prize gaining in a stance of independent critique rather than dependent independency has finally begun, though this is really quite recent, to give way to a certain reflexivity of self-scrutiny. Increasingly, one finds these writers, journalists, and academic critics alike, acknowledging the prize's dependency on denunciation by putatively independent writers, such as themselves. Its need to be represented by them as scandalous and degrading, as a scandalous and degrading instrument of cultural manipulation. Mark Lawson, who's a book review editor at The Independent and was a judge twice for the Booker and was also involved in a couple of Booker scandals himself, Lawson observed in 1994 that the function of the Booker Prize is not simply to promote the cause of serious fiction, but to provoke rows and scandals which may, in due course, promote the cause of serious fiction. Richard Todd, an academic who in 1996 published an entire book on the Booker Prize, dismisses as fatuous the kind of highbrow literary denunciations that have been directed at the prize, and he takes it as surely evident by now that the prize's loftiest critics are its best allies, that the Booker Prize, precisely by getting it wrong, as it cannot fail to do, in the eyes of so many established experts. Alongside this new readiness to acknowledge the smooth working relationship between cultural prizes and their critics, we find more and more a kind of playful or reflexive prize commentary in which scandal seems to circulate in scare quotes, with winks and nudges passing between the ostensibly scandalous artist or jury member, the ostensibly scandalized critic, and the reader. The whole event is seen as being pinned on what a chair of judges at the NCR Nonfiction Prize, that's the major nonfiction prize in Britain, what a chair of judges at that prize called the hope that there might be a row in inverted commas. Doubtless is certain, he said, they certainly didn't appoint me chair of judges for my powers of judgment in literary matters. They appointed me in the hope that there might be a row in inverted commas. Doubtless a certain conscious duplicity or dark hilarity has always been observable in journalism about the Booker Prize and in British cultural journalism generally. But it's become far more conspicuous over the past decade, with fewer critics sounding the note of sincere outrage and more of them openly playing around with scandals that are at least partly of their own invention. Geraldine Brooks, in an account of the 92 award dinner, recalls the feeling of disappointment as things wound down without an embarrassment or a controversy. The judges that year failed even to choose an outright winner, dividing the prize between Barry Unsworth and Michael Ondaatje. The evening seemed flat, anticlimactic, given over to timidity, compromise, and decorum. But soon after the two winners made their acceptance speeches, Ian McEwan, shortlisted also ran for the second time, he has since won the prize, took his publishing entourage and left the guild hall. Brooks seized eagerly on this gesture. Is it possible, she wrote? Yes, he's walking out. Before the closing speech and the toast to poor Salmon who can't be with us. What a relief. The Booker Prize for 1992 will have its scandal after all. This new rhetoric of amused complicity in the manufacture of scandal is an instance of what Bourdieu calls a strategy of condescension, a strategy that enables one to enjoy both the rewards of the game and the rewards due to those who are seen as standing above the game. It does not permit of outright denunciation or implacable opposition, except as a kind of put-on, a form of trash talk, ritual insults within the bounds of the game. It does not allow one to say explicitly and in all seriousness that, as a literary critic or intellectual, one is above such stakes as are at issue in the prize economy. It does still enable one to gesture toward that imaginary separate space on which the ideology and institution of modern art have been predicated, the space outside of all economies where artistic genius is a gift rather than a form of capital, and where the greatness of great art is beyond all measure or manipulation except by the sure determinations of time. But the gesture, which is in any case no longer obligatory, seems more and more often to be oblique, apologetic, ironized. It has come to involve a certain acknowledgement, though I think always a partial and incomplete acknowledgement, that this world apart is a matter of collective make-believe. What used to be describable as the sincere fiction informing commentary on prizes, and indeed underpinning the entire economy of cultural prestige, the fiction of socially unmediated aesthetic value, does remain in place as a kind of necessary predicate today. But this new, or rather newly dominant rhetoric that I've been describing suggests that its sincerity has been problematized in ways that we have not yet come to terms with. What Bourdieu calls the illusio of literature, the fundamental belief in the literary game and in the value of its stakes, has been complicated or compromised by something that is neither a perfect lucidity regarding the objective truth of literature as a fiction founded on collective belief, nor a radical disillusionment from which literary practice can only seem a form of cynical mystification or conscious trickery. We are rather dealing with the kind of suspension between belief and disbelief, between the desire to see art as a kind of Ponzi scheme and the desire to preserve it as a place for our most trusting investments. Under these circumstances, cultural prizes can be at one and the same time both more dubious, more of a joke than they used to be, and more symbolically effectual, more directly and intimately intertwined with processes of canonization. While the Booker's possibly the most talked about of high cultural prizes, its relationships to journalism, to criticism, to scandal, and so on are largely unexceptional. Even in fields of culture to which the press pays far less attention than it does to literature, when a prize makes the news, it's generally due to some scandal which takes the same basic form, increasingly, though never perfectly, parodic or insincere form as those connected with the Booker. Indeed, we find other prizes more and more often being compared to the Booker, usually in order to suggest the, quote, Bookerization, unquote, of the whole cultural prize phenomenon, so that when a scandal or row breaks out in connection with some literary or arts prize these days, those who attack and denigrate or embarrass the prize are less likely to be perceived as acting within the long tradition of sincere animosity between artists and bourgeois consecration, artistic freedom fighters on the old model of art versus money, and more likely to be seen as players in a cultural game whose rules and size are rather more obscure and of which the Booker happens to be the best known instance. Let's consider, for example, the scandals of refusal that periodically and memorably interrupt the regular ceremonies in which prizes are awarded and received. Award ceremonies are rituals of symbolic exchange, requiring of all participants a knowledge of and respect for the conventions attendant upon the giving and receiving of gifts. Any display of indifference or ingratitude on the part of the honored recipient must be calculated with great care, or it will provoke the indignation not only of the presenters of the prize, but of the entire participating community, including, for example, the other nominees as well as all the past recipients of the prize. For this reason, it has always been difficult to profit in symbolic terms by refusing a prize outright. Traditionally, in order to do so, one had to have already accumulated a wealth of symbolic capital of a sort that is collectively regarded as non-fungible with prizes, awards, trophies, so on. The sort, that is, which accrued not to just any recognized aesthetic innovator, but only to those who were also resolute social oppositionists or heretics, old-style intellectuals. These are artists who deployed the prestige granted them in their particular and more or less discrete fields of production. In a broader mission of prophetic subversion, that's a quote from Bourdieu, a mission of prophetic subversion, a political mission in which the existing social order was consistently denounced and the rewards it placed within reach consistently rejected in the name of autonomy. And even for these symbolically powerful figures, refusing a prize was always a delicate and risky maneuver. Sartre's exemplary refusal of the Nobel in 1964 was seen by him as a regrettable entanglement, which he had tried to ward off in advance by writing when he heard he was being considered to the Swedish Academy, urging them to remove his name from the list of candidates. That letter was misplaced by the secretary. If it hadn't been, the whole thing would have been averted, as it was. And the letter was very tactful and said, look, I have always refused prizes, both Soviet and Western prizes. I can't now suddenly make an exception or invalidate, you know, this lifetime practice, so please remove me. But it, and in the event, when he refused the prize, was offered the prize and refused it, he was as low-key and apologetic as he could possibly be, but nevertheless, this refusal was widely regarded as an act of tremendous symbolic violence, a huge scandal, and rightly so. He could have, at that point, accepted the prize, but this is what George Bernard Shaw did, but do it in a sort of reluctant and tactical way, give the money to, Algerian intellectuals and use the occasion of the speech to publicize their cause and so on. There are ways to do this that would save face on all sides. But by refusing even this much contact with the Nobel, Sartre was maintaining a high barrier of exchange, a symbolic trade barrier between his cultural capital, his specific importance and value as an artist and intellectual, and the capital that the Academy held out to. Any transaction between the two would be catastrophically to his disadvantage, and so he had no choice but to refuse, in effect announcing the Academy's proper gift as a Trojan. In 1964, it was still possible to occupy a position on the cultural field from which such a sincere and implacable refusal made symbolic sense. The field was still understood to conform in a broad way to the dualist structure whose emergence in the 19th century Bourdieu describes in the field of cultural production, the rules of art, and elsewhere, the high-low structure. It was characterized, that is to say, by its two subfields of cultural production, the restrictive field, in which avant-garde artists produced art for one another and for university intellectuals, quote, a field that is its own market, allied with an educational system which legitimizes it, unquote. And on the other hand, the general field in which artists of more conventional habits produce for a wider public of bourgeois art lovers and later for mass entertainment audiences. Quote, a field of production organized as a function of external demand, normally seen as socially and culturally inferior, unquote. In a field structured in this way, was still capable of producing prophetic subversive intellectuals more or less on the model of Zola, who could put their symbolic capital, initially hard-won on their restricted fields, to work politically by linking autonomy with truth. Even in the early 70s, there was clearly some measure of symbolic efficacy in such refusals if the artist declining the award was sufficiently admired by others in the field. That Academy Award refusals in these years by Brando, George C. Scott, Louis Buñuel, Woody Allen, come to mind as examples. But by the time Thomas Bernhard writes in the 1982 memoir of his own decision in the 1970s not to accept any more literary awards, on the grounds that for the serious artist, quote, receiving a prize is nothing other than having one's head pissed upon, unquote, this Flaubertian posture seems already a self-consciously dated and curmudgeonly one. Bernhard's novelistic representation of a traditional artist intellectual who finds himself out of place and strategically at a loss on the contemporary field. Bernhard himself had, in fact, resumed accepting awards by then, just as George C. Scott had taken to attending the Academy Awards ceremony. For either to have done otherwise, to have maintained the position of incorruptible refusenik or prophetic subversive, would have made him appear not more authentic or serious as an artist, but more out of date, more plainly part of an earlier generation of artists whose positions have been voided and tactics superseded. One can still refuse a prize, of course, but the refusal can no longer be counted upon to reinforce one's artistic legitimacy by underscoring the specificity or the properly autonomous character of one's cultural prestige. It's different from mere visibility or success. On the contrary, the scandal of refusal has become a recognized device for raising visibility and leveraging success. When Julie Andrews refused a nomination for a 96 Tony Award, no one even considered taking the gesture seriously as an attack on the Tonys, much less as a defense of the integrity or autonomy of the legitimate theater. Instead, it was seen as a media event, carefully staged by Andrews, the biggest star on Broadway, I'm quoting it from the New York Times right after this, playing in one of the biggest grossing hits, and intended to show, to help her show attract even more paying customers. The media scandal surrounding her refusal, despite its involving many disparaging observations about the commercialism of the Tonys, was widely recognized as doing those awards far more good than harm in terms of their future capacity to produce and circulate prestige to attract actors to the show and so on. As Peter Marks put it in the New York Times, Andrews's actions succeeded in doing what Broadway publicity agents thought would be impossible, turning the Tony Awards into a tabloid story, an outcome which did not displease some involved with the promotion of the Tonys. And in fact, the televised Tony Award ceremony that year opened with Julie Andrews jokes, and the whole show seemed to have been scripted around this mock scandalous fact of her absence. Being already a recognized move in a game characterized by insincere or duplicitous antagonisms, the refusal of a prize can no longer register as a refusal to play. Nor can the reluctant player make appeal to some proper home on the cultural field where such games are unknown and where the symbolic money that prizes represent is no good. The artists, writers, and intellectuals who today are major holders of symbolic capital, those whom the culturally esteemed themselves esteem, have for the most part left the task of denouncing prizes to journalists and old guard humanities professors while taking the game up themselves more tactically. A transitional moment, perhaps, was Thomas Pynchon's famous acceptance of the National Book Award for Gravity's Rainbow in 1974. At that time, Pynchon was certainly still capable of refusing a major prize outright, as he did in a deliberately rude letter declining the 1975 Dean Howells Medal of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. The letter read, "I don't want it. Please don't impose on me something I don't want." Short and to the point. And more recently, as you may know, he showed himself willing to accept such an award with no display of reluctance, as he did in MacArthur Genius, so-called Genius Award in 1989. Of course, that comes with a lot of money. Woody Allen was asked in an interview if he would accept the Nobel Prize. He said, Well, that prize comes with an interesting amount of money. So he might break his rule for that. In any case, you see Pynchon adopting these two positions in turn, and an ambiguity of position between the two extremes was nicely captured by his famous handling of the National Book Award, for which he sent a professional comic to accept on his behalf. Some of you probably know this story. The comic, calling himself Professor Irwin Corey, offered by way of an acceptance speech an incomprehensible amalgam of academic jargon and nonsense, bewildering most of those in attendance at the award ceremony and annoying many. This was not exactly a way to renounce the symbolic and material profits associated with the prize. The event increased Pynchon's specific visibility as an invisible recluse writer, thereby augmenting both his celebrity and his special symbolic position as an artist who shuns celebrity, a position he shares with Salinger, most notably. It's interesting to speculate what Salinger's importance would be, his literary importance would be if he weren't, this 40-year recluse. The event also increased the sales of his academically acclaimed but commercially resistant novel, Bradley Frank Book, enabling an imposition of specific academic preferences on the broader book market. Professor Corey's appearance also brought visibility and symbolic stature to the prize itself, which by selecting Pynchon as its winner and securing his acceptance, even on these comic terms, gained some ground in its originary and ongoing struggle to unseat the Pulitzer as America's most legitimate literary award, that is, the one that lines up best with the academically legitimated hierarchy of canon. The Pulitzer that year had also selected Gravity's Rainbow, and that was their one nomination. But the Pulitzer's governing board, which has final say on these things, had in a scandalous, though amply precedented and in some ways predictable, imposition of its heteronomous constraints. The governing board had called the novel obscene and unreadable, rejected the jury's choice, and voted not to award any prize at all that year. This was good for the NBA. At the same time, however, Pynchon clearly made of the award ceremony a kind of parodic version of itself, a false or pretended exchange, a simulation of a consecration, an event which, however well it succeeded in accomplishing its purposes, and I'm saying it succeeded very well, could not quite be taken seriously. His tactics thus suited the postmodern circumstances of the prize, its paradoxically increasing effectivity and decreasing seriousness, as well as prefiguring the whole range of mock prizes, anti-prizes, booby prizes, and flippant pseudo-prizes, which have symptomatically come to shadow and even emerge with the prize industry proper. In connection with this latter point, we might briefly consider two Scottish conceptual artists, Bill Drummond and Jimmy Cauley, who as the pop duo KLF had a string of hit records in the early 1990s. You know the story? Then in 93, they refashioned themselves to K Foundation and announced their sponsorship of a brand new £40,000 prize for the artist who produced the year's worst work of art. The award announcement was timed to follow immediately after the presentation of the only £20,000 Turner Award, the so-called Booker Prize in British Art. And the prize was presented right outside the doors of the Tate Gallery where the Turner Prize was presented. And of course, they announced as their winner the very artist who had just been the Turner, the sculptor Rachel Whiteley. Whiteley even felt compelled to accept the Worst Artist Prize so that she could donate the money to charities rather than give Drummond and Cauley the opportunity to make good on their threat to burn the unclaimed cash immediately. The whole affair clearly mocked the Turner Prize and its sponsors at the Tate Gallery, who earlier that year had refused to exhibit the K Foundation's own work of art, a million pounds of their pop music proceeds, nailed to the wall and tagged as on sale by the artist for £500,000. This never exhibited work of art, by the way. This never exhibited work of art was in fact burned in 1994, as documented in the Foundation's hour-long and scintillating silent film, Watch the K Foundation Burn a Million Quid. It's screened later that year before audiences of rival football teams, supporters of rival football teams in various Glasgow pubs. But this is a curious kind of mockery in a number of respects. It's quite different from a simple denunciation or an act of straightforward antagonism. Part of what the foundation succeeded in demonstrating was that their own worst artist prize wasn't really much different from the Tate's best artist prize. The best and worst, most serious and most frivolous, most legitimate and most commercial, while still in some sense socially viable and even necessary, unavoidable categories, were no longer readily mappable binaries. That the dualist structure of the cultural field had been interestingly scrambled. The artists themselves, after all, were both ultra-commercial pop stars, named the best British band at the previous year's industry-sponsored Brit Music Awards, which are basically the Grammys in Britain. And fringe avant-gardists of the conceptual art world, producing out of the material of their own pop stardom these works, which had no apparent commercial value at all. Their antics suggested that the Turner Prize was already a mock prize, a booby prize, a joke. But also, just as significantly, that their mock prize was for real, imperfectly distinguishable from economic instruments such as the Turner. It, too, is an instrument for converting heteronymous capital, mainly from the mass market, into specific symbolic capital, stature in the legitimate art world, by way of journalistic capital, visibility, celebrity, scandal. And in fact, there's been as much comic book play or playing around with the different forms of capital and their intervertibility by recipients of the Turner Prize as by the Cave Foundation. 2 years after White Reed won the Turner, the award went to Damien Hirst for his now famous work of mutilated cow and calf carcasses, chainsaw cow and calf carcasses, Mother and Child Divided. Hirst played his win for all it was worth, giving the press some scandalous sound bites. It's amazing what you can do with E-grade and A-level art, and twisted imagination, and a chainsaw. And the press beautifully mounted a great show of outrage, calling the award an odious and disgusting scandal, and in reference to the ongoing British beef panic, a case of, quote, mad judge's disease. Much of this was certainly play acting. Hirst Wayne was among the least surprising, least newsworthy events of the year. He was the best-known younger artist in the country, had been shortlisted twice already for the tournament, and was rated a prohibitive 4-5 favorite by the bookmakers at William Hill. And they along with Ladbrokes, offer odds on all the major prizes in art. It's called the Culture File. The arts editors who wrote the event in terms of shock and horror were simply advancing their interests in an ongoing factional struggle between the so-called new British art, or Britpop, and the defenders of so-called tradition. The sheer hyperbole of the rhetoric, Hirst's work was said to have, quote, the aesthetic value of a bucket full of spittle, unquote, suggests that, again, that the scandal of the middle ground, in which cultural prizes have for a century been implicated, has become a highly self-conscious game of positions. Journalist critics seizing on the prize as a way to reanimate flaxen and binarisms between art and money, culture and society, sufficiently, that is, reanimate them sufficiently to fortify their own positions. In these journalistic games of scandal, the defense of art for art's sake is mounted not by a determined avant-garde willing to make long-term investments, but is willing to labor penniless for decades toward the goal of ultimately prevailing in the field of production, but rather by the most comfortably established artists and the most risk-averse journalist critics, even and especially those who are underwritten by and whose habit brings them into accordance with the increasingly active cultural wing of the corporate right. Find, for example, Hilton Kramer, chief art lackey of the Olin Foundation, was in among the anti-Turnerites, who sponsored their own prize called the Jewelry Prize. The modern discourse of autonomy has become a tactical fiction, imperfectly sincere, often a signal of the most egregiously heteronomous principles at work, and hence a treacherous, if not a hopeless, tool for the young or avant-garde or minority artists seeking specific legitimacy. What we see in these most recent award scandals is that the latter artists have been forced not to relinquish their interest in autonomy properly understood, that can never happen, but to pursue it by means of strategies of differentiation, styles of play, which defy a simple dualistic two-axis, four-quadrant geography of cultural positions, a geography in which autonomy can only appear as a kind of safe corner and sanctuary for the good gods. I've got a little coda here. which I will tack on the end. Bourdieu's work has the merit of recognizing the continued urgency of the problem of cultural autonomy, a structural problem involving the relation of cultural and intellectual labor to economic, social, and political capital, which he has rightly insisted on approaching reflexively, that is, as it impinges on our own dispositions and practices as academics. But like those who continue in all seriousness to advocate a posture of perfect indifference or sincere refusal toward cultural prizes, Bourdieu tends to conceive the quest for autonomy, whether pursued collectively or individually, in negative terms, as a matter of refusing gifts, withholding investments, renouncing profits. These terms have less and less relevance to the scene of contemporary cultural production, which requires more playfully positive or appropriative strategies of engagement. We know that special esteem, with the potential for increased symbolic leverage, no longer consistently accrues to the artist whose practice is governed by the law of renunciation. Foregoing the material profits once associated with mass or middle-brow culture cannot be counted upon to enlarge one's credit or raise one's standing among those whose once firm classification as serious artists and intellectuals is itself no longer altogether serious. Nor is this simply because money has penetrated ever deeper into the once independent portions of the cultural field. The preferred Bourdieuian metaphor of interpenetration tends to suggest a field comprised of two discrete zones, respectively dominated by artistic and economic capital, which address each other across a single and definite, but increasingly permeable barrier, a contact zone where the old struggle between art and commerce is carried out. But the different forms of capital are actually caught up in a process of interconversion, of exchange or translation from form to form, at every point of the field simultaneously, and at rates whose negotiation is always part of this process, being carried out by every player in every position. One pursues an interest in autonomy today, not by seeking out some ever narrower margin of the field that remains uncolored by money, by politics, by ethnic or geographic favoritism, but by seizing and managing as effectively as one can the various and scattered cultural instruments whose primary purpose is the negotiation of capital conversions. Prizes have proliferated in the last quarter century, precisely because they have proved so irresistibly well-suited to this task, not simply to facilitating exchange between capital, cultural and non-cultural capital, enabling the holders of money or political power or social connections to appropriate cultural prestige for their own purposes, and the holders of cultural capital, prestige among artists, to cash in their specific recognition, but also to facilitating negotiation of the very rates and barriers of such exchange, negotiations which define the true states of the culture game. Prizes have, to be sure, provided opportunities for the holders of non-cultural assets to drive down the value of cultural assets relative to non-cultural ones. But they have also provided opportunities for those serious artists and writers who know how to work with the non-seriousness of the contemporary award scene to enlarge their scope, the scope of their own authority, to leverage their always dominated positions on the field of power, and so to achieve greater subversive efficacy. And somehow I didn't manage to work Toni Morrison into this talk, but Toni Morrison would be a very good example of someone who's played the prize game in just this way. It may well be that, were we somehow able to perform the necessary calculus, we could confirm the almost universal truism that the proliferation of cultural prizes has done more to further the consolidation and homogenization of capitals than to enlarge the endowments of artists as artists, much less to advance the cause of cultural democratization. But I think we're a long way from being ready to make such a reckoning. What is needed in the meantime is not more speculation about which camp is winning or losing the great game, a game which we probably better stop trying to understand anyway, as involving two sides or two teams. So what's needed is not more speculation about who's on the winning side, but more careful study of the game itself. In particular, we could use some close study of the concrete instruments of exchange and conversion, whose rise is perhaps the most conspicuous feature of our recent cultural history. This is my project. Along with cultural prizes, these would include many new forms of corporate patronage and sponsorship, the underwriting of museum shows and public radio broadcasts in novel ways, the inviting of public intellectuals to lucrative executive conference centers, The supporting of independent filmmakers with product placement deals, these sorts of recent phenomena. They also include the well-funded think tanks and philanthropic foundations and humanities centers that have sprung up both on and off university campuses. The U.S. News and World Report style lists and rankings that now cover every imaginable cultural product or producer. The ubiquitous festivals of art, film, and music, which now number in the tens of thousands. The book club, sponsored by booksellers, and many others. Like prizes, these phenomena have been much written about, but we have barely begun to study them in any detail, to construct their histories, gather ethnographic data from their participants, come to an understanding of their specific logics or rules, and of the different ways they're being played and played with. This is the immediate task for those of us who wish to understand the new conditions under which we're performing our various cultural labors. It's not only a sociological as opposed to a narrowly interpretative or theoretical text, but it's also necessarily a reflexive one, requiring of us systematic attendance to the symbolic and material bases of our own habitual dispositions, including, for many of us, our habitual postures of condescension or refusal, both toward these specific cultural phenomena, prizes, book clubs, and toward the sociological approach to culture in general, an approach which recent contributions notwithstanding, remains embarrassingly crude from the vantage of literary theoretical refinement. After all, academics and students like us can be among the least adept, the least effective players on the contemporary cultural scene, weighted down, as to some degree we have to be, with dispositional freight on body capital that, while traditionally enlisted in the service of culture, is poorly suited to the strategic challenges that face us today. However unsatisfactory we may find Bourdieu's own position on the politics proper to intellectual labor, he's right about one thing. If we're to come up with politically sound cultural strategies and to put them effectively into play, we need more than new ways to deploy our habitual dispositions toward culture, money, and power. We need a new model of the field of cultural production in terms of which those very dispositions can themselves be mapped, scrutinized, and transformed. And that is... Now, it's 7:15. We started with a little bit about that. I'll be glad to answer questions.
Any of these prizes have staging criteria? Or is it anything more specific than the best novel?
They have all kinds of staging criteria. And there's a kind of logic of competition and imitation among prizes themselves. So the people who work in prizes, a big part of the book I'm doing is ethnographic. It's kind of like I'm talking to people who are sort of these functionaries in the prize world. And they're acutely aware of other prizes and of the people who run the other prizes more than they are in the sense of, you know, the art or the cultural stuff that's being evaluated. And as these prizes unfold, you know, over the years, but especially at that first moment when they're founded, the criteria are crucially important in that they need to differentiate themselves. Right? You don't want to be perfectly redundant to other prizes. You want to be differentiated in some respects. But if you get over differentiated, and there are prizes for the best unpublished short novel by a resident of a certain town or community which thematizes that community and life in it in a realistic manner. You know, I mean, there is such a prize, I can't remember what it's called, but there are these very, very tightly drawn criteria which, on the one hand, establish a niche of your own, you know, which is great. On the other hand, tend to trivialize the prize and cut it off from, say, the sort of high-stakes symbolic economy. So there's always this tricky equation. We're trying to juggle specificity with generality. What tends to happen is the prizes start specific. They have very, very particular criteria, very quirky and odd criteria in many cases that, you know, 20 years, 30 years down the road, you look at it and go, how did that happen? But as time goes by, they move toward the center, they broaden their criteria, they relaxed the rules. This is true of the Pulitzer, of the Nobel. If you look at the originary language of these prizes, they had strange stipulations. The winner of the Pulitzer Fiction Prize, that novel had to basically be a patriotic or idealist novel about the American way of life. That's no longer.
Is the Booker a similar transformation?
No, the Booker has changed not at all. The rules and procedures have changed a lot. They've continually revisited sort of the way that they appoint juries and the timing of the announcement and all that sort of thing. But their criteria have always been a novel published the previous year in Britain or the Commonwealth Nations, best novel. Can't win it with short stories, for example. She came to the others. It can't be written by an American. The Orange Prize is a good example of one that found a niche, that wasn't there, that immediately worked. It was the best woman's novel prize. And that was both controversial, because why do women need a special prize of their own? It wasn't good enough to point out that the other prize would keep going to men. So it was a good differentiating strategy in attracting attention, but also being a big, big category with a huge constituency of interested readers and writers.
I wonder if in your book you're going to talk about, from what I've read, this changed the American publishing industry, was Oprah's book prize.
Well, Oprah won the 50th anniversary gold medal of the National Book Foundation last fall. So they're, after 50 years, the National Book Foundation basically exists to give the National Book Award. After 50 years of giving an award, they have their 50th year anniversary and give their award of awards, and it goes to Oprah, okay? And who presents it? Steve Martin, who is the presenter. This starts to look like a kind of convergence, right, of the television celebrity world with the book prize. In a way, Oprah is already, as I guess your question is suggesting, is already sort of working with certain elements of the book prize herself and making them, adapting them to daytime television. She didn't say Oprah had nothing to do with it. Oprah sold the idea, but the idea was worked up by her producers and imposed on her. She didn't like it. So there's an interesting convergence there, and it's part of what people mean when they say Bookerization. It's the supposed transformation of the literary world into the TV world. But in fact, nobody's really scandalized by that. This is what I'm saying is that, or rather, there's a sense of repugnance or horror, but it's only sort of half there. It's blended with the sense of relaxed acceptance. And so it becomes more a matter of tactics than anything else. And Oprah's very interesting. America's greatest tastemaker ever. And maybe that's statistically right. No one else has come close to pointing at a novel and turning it into a top number one bestseller 28 times in a row.
That's pretty good.
Doesn't matter who you are, if you're a literary critic, you can't do that. But Oprah can. Yeah.
A clerical error? And this information you've got about the Booker that you weren't supposed to get.
What was it? Oh, yeah.
First, actually interested in that story, if you want to share it, but also you implied at least that you're seriously considering leaving some of this out of the book, and I'll
just run it. They don't care, so I'm not worried about it.
Another sort of scandal?
Martin, if I asked Martin Goff, if I could quote those documents, he would have to say no. And he's been pretty generous to me. When he's in interviews, he's told me a lot of stuff, and he always says, well, basically, he says it in a nice way, you're an obscure American academic who's going to write an obscure academic book, and so I can tell you this stuff. So he gives me stuff that nobody else, had, the journalists don't get.
But he wouldn't want me to have that because it's full of other people's documents and letters and things like that. No, it's just it's just bad archive keeping on the part of the Book Trust, which is really a very disorganized organization.
So it was in a public file. It shouldn't.
They should have had the two files separated. And the one got.
It wasn't supposed to be mailed.
It was there for 4 years. I was only there for 1 FM more at my trip to London when I discovered that this stuff was there. And I go, oh my God! So I'm working frantically through the years. Not that much stuff. It's the correspondence and the minutes. You know, it's just like a sort of inside documents. And this is one that causes a small operation. But I'm thinking it's there for the whole thing. You know, for all the files that go through these other files. It turned out it was only there for the first 5-6 years. So,
I have to go level. There's a theoretical level. We have a MacArthur, you probably have more, I only have one MacArthur fellow here. Have you like spoken with her?
You mean Susan?
No, Nancy Ferris.
Oh, Nancy Ferris is a MacArthur?
Yeah, on the margin.
And for that matter, I've talked to Susan about hers as well. I've tried not to address in any extended way the academic prizes, even though in a way that's an important dimension of the project. But the educational institution is itself such a complicated world that to take that on, in addition to everything else, you know, so I'm trying, and MacArthur is complicated because it's a very crossover war, but still, the MacArthur is one that I try to sort of keep on the margins of my discussion. I'm really looking at prizes that are for art in some sense, where there's a work of art which is nominated, you know, in the prize, so that the rhetoric of acceptance, presentation, so on, says art, art, art. But that's basically my criterion.
Yeah, because I thought the MacArthur would be interesting because it fluctuates between the art, you know, and the pure intellectual. You have some that's
science, social science.
So that would be like a prime example of that and all of that.
Yeah, no, it is. It's an interesting part of the Genius Award. One thing that these prizes do ideologically is, of course, to support this notion of the great godlike, genius. And they do that partly through these embarrassments and scandals. They functionally, if you remember Roland Barthes in Mythologies, he does this great riff on the profiles, or the day in the life profiles of great writers, and how all the dreck, all the banal, sort of uninteresting stuff about them is merely a way of setting off in relief, the greatness, the magnificence, all that. So it's the same sort of ideological trick, I think, that a lot of the coverage of prizes accomplishes. Okay.
I guess I want to ask about the last section, the question of transformation. And I guess it's the possibility of transforming the sociocultural field. And I was thinking when you said that what we need is a real critical reassessment of the rules of the game, that something of this has actually gone on in the field of politics and to the detriment of politics in the last 20 years, where instead of the quote-unquote discussion of issues, you have pundits who are more and more considering the game of politics itself and spin and things like that, to the point where that's the discussion. There's very little discussion of other issues, etc. And I'm not suggesting for a second that could happen here, but it struck me that actually the most effective critique that I've ever seen of awards was on Simpsons, where Homer Simpson is awarded because everyone in the plan has been awarded, given an award, but Homer doesn't have one.
I've never seen that.
Really?
No, yeah.
So they give him, and the name of the award is Outstanding Achievement in the Field of Excellence. The technique strikes me as being, not a reversal or a subversion, but somehow creating a simulacrum of the award itself in such a way that the award somehow begins to stand, you begin to see the sort of artificiality of the award, and it's this process of demystification. And I'm wondering if that strikes you as possible.
Yeah, just it's jumping my head as you're telling a Simpsons joke. There are, everybody make jokes about awards for awards, but they already exist. Are they worth getting nominated for awards? You know, award shows win awards for best award show. You know, this has been going on already for 20 years. You know, coming back to that starting point about what's happened to politics, this is a strong and important critique of any sociological approach to culture, which is that the content disappears. Right? And what we'll do is try to solve this by claiming that unless you have a feel for the content and work with the content interpretatively, you won't really understand what the game is and how the game is played and so on. So he does his literary critical stuff where he reads Flaubert, you know, incredibly badly. it's terrible stuff. Now that doesn't invalidate the notion that sociology of culture should still be in some way, you know, about the material of the field. There are other books as well that try to do this, and whenever they turn to the literature, I'm thinking here, you know, literary sociology, they're really weak. So I don't know, you know, how to solve that. I'm happy to be doing sociology of culture while other people are doing other things, and to see these as products that, you know, what I try to do in that code, as you understood, is to suggest that it's a specific urgency that I see to this, which is that nobody's really doing it. You know, there's an awful lot published. Thousands and thousands of books are published by English professors every year. There are a few things. There are some, you know, people who are working. Certainly there's work on celebrity. But even there, very little of it is the kind of close, detailed scrutiny of the actual people and instruments, you know, that are at work. They don't really want to do that work. And sociologists don't do it. The bulk of sociology of culture either addresses artists or consumers, preferences. And it breaks that down in a different way. We'll do, you know, sort of who goes to museums and why these kinds of things, which is, you know, perfectly interesting questions. But how about the people who work in the museums? That's what I'm interested in. Who the hell are they? What are they doing? Because these functionaries are becoming more and more numerous and more powerful. And we condescend to them. We regard them as sort of non-figures. We all do, I think, as academics. And that's one of the things I'm trying to say is you have to first of all reflect on that condescension and find some different way of addressing yourself to what's going on in the middle that's not condescending. Do it really ethnographically. They're doing kind of micro-sociology of these things. And obviously not everybody wants to do that kind of work. But I think it's good work. I love these books that, you know, when they get written. So, yeah, Matt?
This is a really clearly thought out question, but on this idea of the content and for versus the health market or how sort of how it plugs into the sociological field. I wonder, and this is like a chicken and egg problem, like does the booker make something middle brow, or, you know, does the booker find what's middle brow and give it awards for being middle brow? I mean, of course there's some kind of envelope for what's considered.
Middle brow, again, it still exists, it still circulates rhetorically, it's still an important category for us. But at the same time, it's not available in an altogether serious and firm way anymore. Neither is it. The two ways people tend to see it is either, well, middle brow, high, low, we left that behind, you know, God, Walter Benjamin, you know, got past that. It's over, it's dead, and it's a straw man, and you shouldn't even be, you know, addressing it. Or the other thing they do is they say, well, it's all those naive people out there who still, you know, think in these terms. They're not like us. I don't think either of those is right. I think that it's still the dualistic system conceiving artistic production still has a very powerful grip on not just the academy at large, but on me, on us. And yet, at the same time, we see through it. And so this is what I describe as this sort of problem in the illusio, this problem of belief that hasn't been really very well articulated. So this is, so the Booker is still accused of, finding middling fiction, or middle-brow fiction, but it's not accused of it in a way that can be taken at face value anymore.
Is it, I mean, it seems like a lot of this sense of the middle-brow comes out of, you know, I'm prone to this, but the sort of pyromantic sense of what is the highbrow, which is defined as something you can't recognize in the year that a book is written. Right. So, like, in the scheme that, as you say in your introduction, kind of creates this sense of art, it's by definition impossible for something truly highbrow to be recognized as such in by its immediate audience. That's kind of the whole Wordsworthian and Sheldon point, is that the truly highbrow is recognized later. I wonder if you find that.
But what's interesting about that is that that time does this, is sort of, it's that empty homogeneous time, you know, of Benjamin. It's not real time, because if you just did it, if you just put it as real time, you know, against the time of the prize, the time of consecration, then it's like, well, you know, the difference between what happens socially, politically, commercially in a year versus what happens socially, politically, commercially, you know, in 30 years. It's the same process, and there's no reason to regard one as wrong, you know, or as scandalous or as unreliable even. So that in postulating this, you know, time, the work of time, that will somehow fix these problems, it's another way of trying to get outside of the actual, you know, messiness of capital, the unavailability of any capital distinct from others, not engaged in some kind of a constant negotiation. So I don't think, in other words, the time really is, you know, the factor. But it's true that in the rhetoric of prize bashing, time with a capital T always gets dragged in there. Yeah. And it's true also that this all reports back not so much to the romantic period, but even to you know, what's called the double discourse of value of you know, the emergence of aesthetics in the 18th century. Which, you know, as we know, that double discourse of value whereby money and art are set in a perfect opposition to each other, each understanding of value necessary for the existence of the other, that's all been well critiqued and sort of done away with, and yet it's still, I think, you know, very much part of how we think of art. It doesn't go away. It just takes on this somewhat shifting character.
Do you talk at all about prizes that are really cash cows, where there's an entrance fee?
Yeah, totally legitimate prizes. I don't talk about them except to say that they exist, and that the dividing line can be a little bit hard, you know, to recognize. For example, in the very highest, those tend to be sort of low art. It's like big eyed child paintings. You know, the best big eyed child painting wins the prize, and the prize is we will sell it for you and give you 50%. All right, in other words, we'll market it and take a normal commission, and the entrance fee is $250. Okay, so you know, it's a profit-making venture. But if you look at poetry prizes, the very, you know, high end, the ultra legitimate end, where there's no market to speak of, the prize is we'll publish it and keep the money. Not that there really is any, but still, that's the arrangement. In other words, the contract, when the gift is destroyed as a gift, because it's a contract, and there are written obligations, commercial obligations, can no longer function as a gift, you would think. And yet, in certain fields, like poetry prizes, there is a contract, and it doesn't seem to undermine the symbolic power of the prize. There are also the TV prizes that are on cable, you know, every other night, where the celebrity who gets the prize is the one who shows up. He says, I'll show up. You know, his people say, her people say, yes, she'll show up if you give her the prize. And so you can be sure when you show a famous face in the audience, they're getting the prize, because no one would be there who's not getting the prize. It's all, you know, prearranged, and the only purpose of the award is to produce this show. So those also are strictly commercial. But they too have a certain symbolic.
Well, that's what I think is interesting. Prizes that have other motives but are also feeding on.
Continue to, yeah.
Are even possible because of the kinds of cultural capital that are created by prizes or used by prizes?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, but
it's a very easy question, but do you, are there prizes for the prizes, not as the award ceremonies, but as actual objects? With the proliferation of the prizes, someone has to design a nice gold bowl or whatever.
Best statuette. I don't think there is such a prize. I don't think so. But there are competitions, of course. You know, this is part of the sort of competition system that predates modern culture prize, where, you know, the best statue will be used. More typically, though, there's an attempt to find, to identify the artist who somehow resonates with, you know, the agenda of the prize at the early moment when the thing's being founded, and try to match the artist with the prize so that a Canadian prize would have a Canadian sculptor who perhaps, you know, is somehow connected with that other field of art, and et cetera. But there's a subsidiary economy, parasitic economy, of these objects, which is extremely interesting. They don't so much, don't win awards, but boy, they are bought and sold, and they're trademarked, and they're fought over, and the attorneys at the Academy, the North Picture Academy, are fierce. And blah, blah, blah. You saw the thing this year when they were stolen. They gave that guy who found them, the reward was like $50,000.
And he got to come to the award ceremony.
And he got to come to the award ceremony, and he got his kid there, he got invitations right. He kept working on it for more stuff. He milked it, but the value of those things was about $400 each, and a lot more than the value. In reward, so they're putting a monetary value on the symbolic value.
Right.
And if you could sell them, which you can't, because the Motion Picture Academy will take it away, you could get a lot for some of these, Oscar sculptures. We should maybe talk in particular. Thank you very much.